Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. This week we celebrate Purim, so I thought I'd read you a Purim story. This one, The Purim Gift, is taken from Isaac Bashevis Singer's memoir, In My Father's Court. Singer's father was a rabbi who often had to settle disputes between neighbors. This story tells of how one year, the traditional exchanging of gifts, or shalachmanis, at Purim, nearly led to a din Torah, a court case, in the rabbi's house.
Our home was always half unfurnished. Father's study was empty except for books. In the bedroom, there were two bedsteads, and that was all. Mother kept no food stocked in the pantry. She bought exactly what she needed for one day and no more, often because there was no money to pay for more. In our neighbors' homes, I had seen carpets, pictures on the walls, copper bowls, lamps, and figurines. But in our house, a rabbi's house, such luxuries were frowned upon. Pictures and statuary were out of the question. My parents regarded them as idolatrous. I remember that in the Heder, I had once bartered my Pentateuch for another boy's because the frontispiece of his was decorated with pictures of Moses holding the tablets and Aaron wearing the priestly robe and breastplate, as well as two angels. Mother saw it and frowned. She showed it to my father. Father declared that it was forbidden to have such pictures in a sacred book. He cited the commandment, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness." Into this stronghold of Jewish Puritanism, where the body was looked upon as a mere appendage to the soul, the Feast of Purim introduced a taste of luxury. All the neighbors sent shalachmanis, Purim gifts. From early afternoon, the messengers kept coming. They brought wine, mead, oranges, cakes, and cookies. One generous man sent a tin of sardines, another smoked salmon, a third sweet and sour fish. They brought apples carefully wrapped in tissue paper, dates, figs, anything you could think of. The table was heaped with delicacies. Then came the masked mummers, with helmets on their heads and cardboard shields and swords, all covered with gold or silver paper. For me, it was a glorious day. But my parents were not pleased with this extravagance. Once a wealthy man sent us some English ale. Father looked at the bottle, which bore a colorful label, and sighed. The label showed a red-faced man with a blonde mustache wearing a hat with a feather. His intoxicated eyes were full of pagan joy. Father said in an undertone, "How much thought and energy they expend on these worldly vanities." Later in the day, Father would treat the Hasidim with the wine. We didn't eat the Warsaw cakes, for we were never certain just how conscientious Warsaw Jews were about the dietary regulations. One could not know whether the pastries had been baked with chicken fat and must therefore not be eaten together with any milk foods. The mummers, too, were disposed of quickly, for the wearing of masks and the singing of songs smacked of the theater. And the theater was treif, unclean. In our home, the world itself was treif. Many years would have passed before I began to understand how much sense there was in this attitude. But Krachmalna Street did not wish to take note of such thoughts. For Krachmalna Street, Purim was a grand carnival. The street was filled with maskers and bearers of gifts. It smelled of cinnamon, saffron, and chocolate, of freshly baked cakes, and all sorts of sweets and spices whose name I did not know. The sweet shop sold cookies in the shapes of King Ahasuerus, Haman the Wicked, the Chamberlain Harbona, Queen Vashti, and Vaisatha, the tenth son of Haman. It was good to bite off Haman's leg or to swallow the head of Queen Esther. And the noisemakers kept up a merry clamor in defiance of all the Hamans of all the ages. Among betrothed couples, and boys and girls who were going with each other, the sending of Purim gifts was obligatory. This was part of the customary exchange of engagement presents. Because of one such Purim gift, an argument arose that almost led to a din Torah in our house. A young man sent his betrothed a silver box, but when she opened it, in the presence of her sister and her girlfriends, who were impatiently awaiting the arrival of the gift, she found it contained a dead mouse. She uttered an unearthly shriek and fainted. The other girls screeched and screamed. After the bride-to-be had been revived with compresses of cold water and vinegar, and her friends had collected their wits, they began to plot revenge. The bride-to-be knew the reason for her boyfriend's outrageous deed. Several days before, they had quarreled. After much talk and discussion, the young women decided to repay the malicious youth in kind. Instead of a dead mouse, however, they sent him a fancy cake filled with refuse. The baker was party to the conspiracy. The girls of Krakhmalna Street looked upon this conflict as a war between the sexes, and Krakhmalna Street had something to laugh about that Purim. The strange part of it was that the young man, although he had committed a revolting act, had not expected an equally odious retaliation, and was no less stunned than his fiancée had been. People quickly added imaginary incidents. The girls of Krakhmalna Street always believed in laughing. One often heard bursts of uncontrolled laughter that might have come from an insane asylum. This time they chortled and chuckled from one end of the street to the other. The young man, too, had been surrounded by friends at the festive Purim meal. He, too, had been aided and abetted in his prank. Yes, that Purim was a merry one. But the next morning, everyone had sobered up and the warring clans came to us for a din Torah. The room was jammed full with people. The bride-to-be had brought her family and her girlfriends, and the groom was accompanied by his relatives and cronies. All of them were shouting as they climbed up the stairs, and they kept on shouting for half an hour or more. And my father had yet to learn who was the accuser, who the defendant, and what the tumult was about. But while they were yelling, screaming, hurling insults and curses, Father quietly pored over one of his books. He knew that sooner or later they would grow calm. Jews, after all, are not bandits. In the meanwhile, before more time had been wasted, he wanted to know what Rabbi Samuel Eliezer Edel's meant by the comment in his book, The Maharsha, and one might also say. I was present in the room and soon knew all about the affair. I listened attentively to every insult, every curse. There was quarreling and bickering, but every once in a while, someone ventured a mild word or the suggestion that it was senseless to break off a match for such foolishness. Others, however, raked up sins of the past. One minute their words were wild and coarse, but the next minute they had changed their tune and were full of friendship and courtesy. From early childhood on, I have noted that for most people, there is only one small step between vulgarity and refinement, between blows and kisses, between spitting at one's neighbor's face and showering him with kindness. After they had finished shouting, and everyone had grown hoarse, someone at last related the entire story to my father. Father was shocked. "Shame," he said. "How can anyone do such things? It's a violation of the law. Ye shall not make your souls abominable." Father immediately cited a number of biblical verses and laws. First, it was impious. Second, it was loathsome. Third, such acts lead to anger, gossip, slander, discord, and whatnot. It was also dangerous, for the victim, overcome by nausea, might have become seriously ill. And the defilement of edibles, the food which God had created to still man's hunger, and over which benedictions were to be recited, was in itself a sacrilege. Father recalled the sage who used to say that he merited long life if only because he had never left breadcrumbs lying on the ground. He reminded them that, in order for a cake to be baked, someone had to till the soil and sow the grain, and then rain and dew had to fall from heaven. It was no small thing that out of a rotting seed in the earth a stalk of wheat burst forth. All the wise men of the world together could not create such a stalk. And here, instead of thanking and praising the Almighty for his bounty, men had taken this gift and used it to provoke their neighbors, had defiled what he had created. Where formerly there had been an uproar, silence now reigned. The women wiped their eyes with their aprons. The men bowed their heads. The girls bashfully lowered their eyelids. After Father's words, there was no more talk of a Din Torah. A sense of shame and solemnity seemed to have overcome everyone. Out of my father's mouth spoke the Torah, and all understood that every word was just. I was often to witness how my father, with his simple words, routed pettiness, vain ambition, foolish resentment and conceit. After Father's admonition, the bride and groom-to-be made peace. The mothers, who just a few minutes before had hurled insults at each other, now embraced. Talk of setting a date for the wedding was heard. My father received no fee, for there had been no actual Din Torah. His words of mild reproach had damaged his own livelihood. But no matter, for the weeks between Purim and Passover were a time of relative prosperity for us. Together with the Purim delicacies, the neighbors had sent a half ruble or a ruble each. And soon the pre-Passover sale of leavened bread would begin. When the study had emptied, Father called me over and cautioned me to take heed of what may happen to those who do not study the Torah, but concern themselves only with the vanities of this world. The next Sabbath, after the chont, the Sabbath stew, I went out on the balcony. The air was mild, the snow had long since melted, the pavements were dry. In the gutter flowed little streamlets whose ripples reflected the blue of the sky and the gold of the sun. The young couples of Krakhmalna Street were starting out on their Sabbath walks. Suddenly, the two who had sent each other the ugly gifts passed by. They walked arm in arm, chatting animatedly, smiling. A boy and his girl had quarreled. What of it? I stood on the balcony in my satin gabardine and my velvet hat and gazed about me. How vast was this world, and how rich in all kinds of people and strange happenings! And how high was the sky above the rooftops! And how deep the earth beneath the flagstones! And why did men and women love each other? And where was God, who was constantly spoken of in our house? I was amazed, delighted, entranced. I felt that I must solve this riddle, I alone with my own understanding.
Well, we hope you enjoyed our story and that you have a merry Purim. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. I'll leave you now with Tahai Yeshva Zois by Frank London's Klezmer Brass All-Stars featuring Kol Isha, from the CD, The Rough Guide to Klezmer Revival. See you next week.